we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you with us on the program. It's our Monday live edition of the show. Got a couple guests lined up in the second and the third segment, so you won't want to miss that. And we have a pretty jam-packed show today, so glad you're joining us. I'm not sure which day is not busy on the program. They all are, hopefully, because we try to pack in as much content as we can. Walker Wildman here. Rick Green and I are with you each week here on American Family Radio. If you want to live stream the program, you can do so on Facebook or over on stream.afa.net, stream.afa.net. That's for video purposes. If you want to subscribe to the podcast, we would appreciate that. And you can do so by typing in the name of the show, At the Core, and clicking the subscribe button on your podcast library. And then you'll have the show queued up in your library each and every day. Proverbs 2 is where we are this week. Proverbs 2, 6, and 7. For the Lord gives wisdom, from his mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk in integrity. And I promise I didn't plan this, but Bobby, last week I made the statement that there is no knowledge, there is no wisdom except through God, our Creator. And here we are, two chapters into Proverbs, and it says in verse 6, "For the Lord gives wisdom, from his mouth come knowledge and understanding."
Right. And for verse 10, "For wisdom will enter your heart, and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul."
Yep. Amen. So to think that man can be knowledgeable, can be wise, can be anything of virtue apart from God is to be misled.
Yeah, and as you were saying, you know, is it coincidental? We don't believe in coincidence here. It's all providential.
Not at all. That's right.
Guidance. So,
amen.
Again, God had the plan, and it started last week, and here we are.
Amen. So it's the Lord that gives wisdom and the Lord that gives knowledge and understanding. That's Proverbs chapter 2, verse 6 and 7. All right, couple events I want to give you a heads up about. We've got three upcoming AFA events. We've got the Activate Summit in June. We have the Weekend with AFA and AFA at the Ark, both in October, one at the beginning of October, the latter at the end of October. And all three of these events, we would love for you to join us, and you can simply go to afa.net/events to check out those dates. So the one upcoming, with registration actually ending mid-April, is that Activate Summit. So you're going to want to go ahead and register for that. That's taking place mid-June, June 12th through the 14th. Go ahead and register for that. Registration closes mid-April, about 4 weeks out. And then the other two are in the fall. There's a little bit of time left on those, but still check those out over at afa.net/events, afa.net/events. And then lastly is something I announced on Friday, but we've got all of our tours published now for the next, let's say, 18 months or so. So if you want to join us in Washington, D.C., Williamsburg, Virginia, Jamestown, Yorktown, Boston, Greece, and Israel. Now, the Greece and Israel, that's in 2026. That's in about 12 months from now. But we went ahead and opened registration. If you want to check out any of those tours, those spiritual heritage tours, you can go to wildmangroup.com to check it out. Wildmangroup.com to check that out. Bobby, we're close to full, not quite full, but for Boston, that's your old stomping grounds.
It is.
But you and I were talking about Greece. which we've got, we have six registrations, and we hadn't even talked about it really.
Right. Right.
But that's an exciting, the footsteps of Paul is an exciting part of the world. I've never done it.
It is. And it's, I think the neat part of it is whoever goes to Greece, hopefully Denise and I will be in that count. And, it's going to be the first time that Wildman Group has attacked that tour, if you will. And so the beauty of it is those who join us, join you and Wesley.
For the first.
It's uncharted territory for us all.
That's right.
It's so exciting.
We're looking forward to it, folks. And all of these tours, as you can tell, are spiritual heritage tours in nature, right? We're talking about God's providence, God's hand, not only on America, of course, but on other parts of the world where God worked through different people. So with Greece, we're talking about the Apostle Paul, Athens, Thessalonica, Philippi, so on and so forth. That's just not even a drop in the bucket. And then, of course, Israel, there's just rich history in the Holy Land. So all of that's coming up over the next 12 months. So wildmangroup.com is where you can check out those tours over the next 12 months. All right, let's jump into some of the news stories for the week. The Secretary of State Rubio was actually talking and answering questions about some of these pro-Hamas students that are on visas in America. Now, this has been happening for some time. We're permitting some of these Muslim or Muslim sympathizing students to come in on these visas to these college campuses, and they're straight up radicals. They're radicals. I mean, they're rallying for Hamas. They're threatening Jews, shouting anti-Semitic terms, and causing a lot of disruptions. And remember, these are visas. These are not American citizens. These are people here on temporary visas, which doesn't come with it the kind of due process rights that maybe a U.S. citizen might have. So it's a whole different ballgame. But Secretary Rubio, who's doing a fantastic job, by the way, he teaches us, he lectures us about why it's appropriate to expel pro-Hamas students that are here on visas. Clip one.
President Trump appealed to a lot of Americans during his campaign on free speech arguments and not suppressing speech, especially from the government. But your revocation of the green card, to many, is seen as one of the most anti-speech actions a secretary can take with his powers. How do you respond?
Yeah, when you enter this is an important point, and I'm glad you asked this question. When you come to the United States as a visitor, which is what a visa is, which is how this individual entered this country, on a visitor's visa, okay, you are here as a visitor. We can deny you that visa. We can deny you that if you tell us when you apply, hi, I'm trying to get into the United States on a student visa. I am a big supporter of Hamas, a murderous, barbaric group that kidnaps children, that rapes teenage girls, that takes hostages, that allows them to die in captivity, that returns more bodies than live hostages. If you tell us that you are in favor of a group like this, and if you tell us when you apply for your visa, and by the way, I intend to come to your country as a student and rile up all kinds of anti-Jewish student, anti-Semitic activities. I intend to shut down your universities. If you told us all these things when you applied for a visa, we would deny your visa. I hope we would. If you actually end up doing that, once you're in this country on such a visa, we will revoke it. And if you end up having a green card, not citizenship, but a green card as a result of that visa while you're here in those activities, we're going to kick you out. It's as simple as that. This is not about free speech. This is about people that don't have a right to be in the United States to begin with.
Yep.
No one has a right to a student visa. No one has a right to a green card, by the way. So when you apply for a student visa or any visa to enter the United States, we have a right to deny you for virtually any reason. But I think being a supporter of Hamas and coming into our universities and turning them upside down and being complicit in what are clearly crimes of vandalization, complicit in shutting down learning institutions. There are kids at these schools that can't go to class. You pay all this money to these high-priced schools that are supposed to be of great esteem, and you can't even go to class. You're afraid to go to class because these lunatics are running around with covers on their face, screaming terrifying things. If you told us that's what you intended to do when you came to America, we would have never let you in.
Yep.
And if you do it once you get in, we're going to revoke it and kick you out.
Look, let's just end the wokeism. Let's end the entitlement mentality. Zero student visas are required to be issued by law. All right. This is out of the generosity of the American people. This is out of the goodness of our heart. We are not obligated to issue visas, whether it be work visas, student visas, or otherwise. Okay. And so to think that we have to import on visas people who hate America and hate Jews, to think that we have to do that is to be woefully misinformed. Okay. And so I'm thankful that the White House and the State Department are tackling this issue, because raise your hand if you're tired of America being taken advantage of. Everybody is tired, for the most part, of America being taken advantage of, and this mentality out there that we owe the world something, that we owe these foreigners something, that we owe these people that want to come to America and participate in our universities, that we owe this to them, that they're entitled to it. That's just not true. And we 100% should not be permitting students to come over here under visas that hate America and hate our allies. We just shouldn't permit it. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't work out in our interest. And this is where there's this like falsehood out there that we're supposed to be this charitable country that puts our interest aside and is just a lapdog for the world. And basically get taken advantage of at every turn. Like, where does that ideology come from? It doesn't even... There's nothing sensical about that. There's nothing sensible about that. Unless it's about the Marxist anti-American ideology, which covers itself as being virtuous and noble and charitable, but really underneath it's destructive. And this is what socialism is. It sounds good on the surface, but underneath it's toxic. And it's the same thing with this Marxist ideology that really hates America and wants us to be, you know, the policemen of the world, and we just take everybody's, you know, down and trodden into America, and we'll just take care of everybody, and we'll give everybody money, and you can come here. We don't care what your background is, or if you hate us, you can still come here. No, that's not how, that's unsustainable, okay? That's unsustainable. And so I think we need to be a 100% merit-based immigration system. 100% merit-based immigration system. And yes, there's going to be a time for asylum programs and for refugee programs. Those things have been around for decades, over 100 years. But the vast majority, if not 90-plus percent of immigrants, legal immigrants to this country, should be coming through based on merit. And based on what can they contribute to America's economy, America's education system, and America's industries? What can you contribute to our country as a whole? And then that's why you're getting a permission to enter this nation. And if at any point during your stay here, you begin to advocate for things that are not in America's interest, then you're gone. And that's what Secretary Rubio is saying, that if these folks would have been honest in their visa applications and they would have let us know that they were pro-Hamas agitators, radical Islamists, then they likely would have never been let in the country to begin with. And we've also, while we're on the topic, we have to re-examine this whole immigration system to begin with. I'm talking legal immigration system. We've got to re-examine this entire legal immigration system and make sure that we're not hurting American workers here. This gets into the H-1B visas and other visa programs. We cannot be hurting American citizens under the guise of these visa programs.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the program. Walker Wildman here with you. Second segment is now underway. You're listening to American Family Radio, and we do have our Share-a-thon, our twice annual Share-a-thon coming up in April. The first, technically, I think the second week of April, but we're excited to have Share-a-thon with you coming up early April. We do it twice a year, but the reason I mention that is because we are fielding listener testimonies, at least for the next week or two. So if you've been positively impacted by American Family Radio, if God has used AFR in your life, we would love to hear your story. If you can keep it about 60 seconds, 2 minutes, that would be great. Here's the number to call in, 877-876-8893. If you want to call in, leave your testimony, leave your story about AFR's impact on your life, you can call 877-876-8893. We would love to hear from you, and that's just as much an encouragement for us as it is for our listeners during Share-a-thon. All right, jumping to our guest that we have on this segment, Chris Denson's with us. He's Director of Policy and Research over at the Georgia Public Policy Foundation, and he's on with us to talk about Medicaid and what we need to know about this policy discussion. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon. Glad to be with you.
Well, Chris, we've been having a guest on occasionally to kind of bring us a layperson's perspective of Medicaid, because this is in the news and this is in the policy discussions, not just at the state level, but at the federal level as well, because many of these programs, not all, but many of these entitlement programs, if you will, are in some way facilitated at the federal level. A lot of money goes through Washington for these programs. But then the state, in many cases, ends up kind of managing the program, if you will, and facilitating the program. And in this case, we're talking Medicaid. But before we get into Medicaid reform, Medicaid expansion, work requirements, things like that, give us kind of an overview of what Medicaid is.
Absolutely. So Medicaid, not to be confused with Medicare, which is the health insurance program for seniors 65 and older. Medicaid was initially intended as a health insurance program from the federal government in partnership with the states to offer health coverage for the age blind and disabled population. And over time, including since the passage of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, we've really seen an expansion of Medicaid towards able-bodied individuals. And I think that's a lot of what you're seeing in terms of the political debate today and how far should that program go.
Let's break this down, because there's a federal role and then there's the state role. Let's start in Washington and maybe we'll end up at the state level, because that's your specialties in Georgia and, of course, handling state policy on this matter and others. But at the federal level, all right, so the narrative that is used against anyone who dares to bring up anything about reform or changing how we do Medicaid, et cetera, or any entitlement program for that matter, they get accused of wanting to cut grandma's check, cut grandma's health care, XYZ, that's basically you have no heart, you're uncompassionate, and you're just trying to be greedy and basically take benefits away from people. All right, that's the narrative, and that's why Republicans are so skittish on this issue of reforming how Medicaid is distributed and handled. So break down that falsehood and talk about why there are some legitimate reforms that are needed for this, for the long-term solvency of the program.
Absolutely. And so I think the actual policy itself is leading to a lot of the political discussions we're hearing today. As I mentioned, the Affordable Care Act expanded Medicaid to healthy-bodied, able-bodied individuals at 138% of the federal poverty level and below. And what you've seen since then is 40 states plus the District of Columbia have accepted Medicaid expansion. And ultimately, you know, the federal government pays for 90% of those able-bodied individuals that are now on Medicaid. And as we are entering the second Trump administration, and, you know, you hear the president and congressional leadership and his cabinet quite often mentioning waste, fraud, and abuse. Yeah. Medicaid is one of those programs they've really targeted for that. And because of that, you know, there's a lot of different factors that play into why Medicaid has become ripe for waste, fraud, and abuse. But, you know, if they want to get serious about reducing the deficit, that's one area in which you're going to see that. However, because we've seen red states, Republican states that have chosen to expand Medicaid, it's making it a little bit trickier politically, especially, you know, I heard Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri mention recently that, you know, he envisions Medicaid as a program for the working poor and single mothers. And so in addition to this political realignment you're seeing at the national level, yeah, in addition to these Republican states that have expanded Medicaid, it's a really complicated political factor right now. Some political factors going on right now.
All right, let me ask you this, Chris, before we move forward. So what you just described there is that basically Medicaid expansion was that the idea of Medicaid expansion came from the federal level through Obamacare and was basically incentivizing states to expand Medicaid. I'm sorry, I said Medicare. The Medicaid, we're talking Medicaid. And that the problem is that the two programs are named quite similarly, and it makes it very difficult to parse these out. But we're talking Medicaid. But you're saying that the incentivizing of expanding Medicaid and basically the federal covering of that came from the federal level. Is that the understanding there?
Yes, it's a state partnership, probably in name only, because if the states want to reform or, you know, kind of change the structure of their program, which we'll get into a little bit here with Georgia, they have to ask for permission.
Let me ask this, Chris. I'm sorry I keep interrupting you, but I'm trying to make sure our audience knows what's going on here.
Sure.
Who birthed the terrible idea of expanding Medicaid? Because this is already a massive program. But who said, hey, guys, let's expand this thing, and then everybody else said, hey, that's a great idea. Like, where was this birthed?
It was one of the key tenets of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And so you see, you know, but, you know, obviously a lot of blue states were some of the first to sign up for expansion, but you've since seen red states. I know Mississippi's discussed it. Georgia's discussed it. You know, when you have like a holdout of 10 states left, and the federal government is dangling so much money, taxpayer dollars, mind you. You know, most supporters will say this is free money that states are turning down, but we're talking about taxpayer dollars here, and that makes the politics of it, you know, a little bit tough to navigate.
Yeah. So that's what you just answered there is perfect, because I know you work with Dr. Jameson Taylor on our team, and I've heard this kind of connection back to Obamacare. But that just makes it plain and clear that there would be no Medicaid discussion, Medicaid expansion discussion, had there not been the Affordable Care Act, i.e. Obamacare, which is not affordable at all. So this all goes back to Obama. And if you put it in those terms, then Republicans should understand, hey, maybe this isn't a good idea because this originated from Obamacare back during Obama's term. All right, so let's shift to, before we shift to the states, talk about the money here, because this is, you mentioned the feds basically dangling, Washington is dangling money, you know, around these states saying, basically you need to take this, offering to cover up to 90%, you said, of the cost of expanding Medicaid. But talk about how much these programs cost, and how, DC's already running a massive deficit. So it's not like we've got just surplus money sitting around. Washington's already pretty stretched when it comes to the deficit.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing, and going back to something we touched on earlier, what you've heard President Trump discuss, what you've heard some congressional Republicans say is we need to go after waste, fraud, and abuse. And just a couple of things that they mean by that is, you know, you hear about this idea that we should block grant Medicaid. So essentially putting a cap on what the states can spend in terms of Medicaid, what the federal government's willing to cover. You're also hearing ideas like we should dial back that 90-10. And if you take away that carrot for the Medicaid expansion population, the able-bodied individuals, will you then in fact see states quit, expanding Medicaid as rapidly as we've seen over the last 15 years. And then lastly, another thing as well that really ties into, the way that the federal government dangles this carrot in front of states is there's a lot of different financing mechanisms out there. And in Georgia, what we see is for every dollar that the state sends to D.C., we receive $2 in return. And so all the hospitals and other providers are taxed across the board. They collect a pot of money. That money is sent to D.C., and then it comes back in the form of 2X, basically. So we receive $3 in Medicaid spending for every $1 that we send to D.C. And, when we're talking about in Georgia, that's about a $13 billion Medicaid budget that we have right now. And, not just in Georgia only. I mean, before the pandemic, we saw that Medicaid was the largest item in every state's budget. So it crowds out other non-discretionary spending like education. And then it accounts for about 30% of total state expenditure. So we're really starting to see just a large growth of this program crowding out a lot of other items in the state budget.
Yeah, that's right. And that's another important note, because to your point earlier, the quote unquote draw from a financial perspective for the states is, the feds are going to cover 90% of this. But over the long run, that's not very sustainable unless the state's running a very healthy surplus budget. That 10% grows over time. And the 90%, by the way, is just an initial kind of guarantee. That doesn't mean that's how it will always be. So it's very well that the states end up picking up more than 10% over the long haul. Once again, we're talking to Chris Denson. He's Director of Policy and Research over at the Georgia Public Policy Foundation. All right, Chris. So if the states do decide that the 10 or so remaining basically Republican-led states that haven't expanded Medicaid, if they decide they want to kind of delve into this discussion, although I'm just flat out against it just because I think there's too many sinkholes, but you guys are working on some of the areas that can be reformed to make it basically not as bad. So talk about some areas that states need to focus on. If they're going to expand Medicaid, some areas they need to focus on.
Well, so if there's one thing that I could share today that I'd love for your audience to take away that they won't hear, when the media is normally covering this Medicaid expansion discussion. Basically, the way they frame it, if we just put all these eligible individuals on Medicaid, it solves the world's problems. In Georgia, less than 60% of physicians accept new Medicaid patients, and that's because they get paid less than cost. You think about someone that has commercial insurance, they come in there, the doctor gets about, they get about 150% reimbursement, whereas on Medicaid, it's under 80%. So they lose money. Hospitals and physicians alike lose money on Medicaid patients. But the other thing, and this is the big takeaway I was just alluding to, when we talk about expanding Medicaid, in Georgia, for example, we will be taking off people that currently have private health insurance through our Georgia Health Insurance Marketplace and putting them on to Medicaid. So they'd be less likely to find a physician that accepts their health insurance coverage. And they go from having a better plan to being on government insurance. And that's what, for example, here, we have over 700,000 Georgians that currently have a private health insurance through like a Blue Cross Blue Shield, a Cigna. You think of all those private health insurance companies, and they would then in fact go on to government run health insurance if we were to expand Medicaid. And I'm sure Mississippi is the same way, because it's just the incentive structures that they put in Obamacare make it as such. But we try to tell people that's something that's often underreported, and we want to just stress that, you would be taking hundreds of thousands of Georgians off good private health insurance plans and putting them on government-run health insurance if you were to expand Medicaid.
Well, and we know that the author of Obamacare and others, that one of the goals here is they basically view government as being God with a little g, and the goal here from kind of the architects of Obamacare is to get everybody on the government-run programs, whether it's health insurance or even health care, both. I know those are distinctly different things, but the goal here is more government and less private sector, and that's a problem because when you look at what's going on in Canada and other places, this government-run health insurance is an absolute disaster. Number one, government can't get into the health care business in any type of scale just because the resources aren't there. So they want to get into the health insurance business so they can control everybody's health insurance. And then that's when you begin rationing care, which is what goes on in Canada today. People get denied surgeries because they're either, quote, too old or they don't fit the right profile. I mean, it's very scary, actually, when you look at it. So, Chris, a final word on the dangers and the threats of this Medicaid expansion and this more government involvement in the health insurance industry.
Absolutely. And one other point, you know, here in Georgia, for example, we have over 7,000 people that are on the waiting list for the age-blind, disabled Medicaid healthcare. And so you're seeing able-bodied individuals crowd out the truly neediest among us, those that have multiple just health issues. And so that's something, you know, we'd always want to stress as well, that we need to make sure that we're getting health coverage to those that truly need it the most.
Absolutely. Hey, Chris, thanks so much for your work. Appreciate you coming on.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it. Have a great one. Bye.
All right. GeorgiaPolicy.org, by the way, is their URL. GeorgiaPolicy.org is that URL. That was Chris Denson. Fascinating discussion. We've got to become educated on this stuff, folks. I know it's kind of wonky, it's kind of nerdy, not very exciting, but it has broad implications. It has broad implications for our states. So we got to talk about it. All right, we'll be back in a few.
Thoughts of the child you were carrying keep pouring over in your mind. A deep, unrelenting sadness overshadows your days, and you wonder if you will ever feel whole again. There is hope and healing from a reproductive loss. Call the International Helpline, 866-482-LIFE, and talk with someone who has been where you are. Your call is confidential, and we will help you find healing. 866-482-LIFE.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome to The Core, back to the program for our last segment of today's show. As a reminder, we would love for you to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Just type in the name of this show, and you can click the subscribe button wherever you listen to podcasts. I mentioned coming into the show today, those few events that we have coming up over the next several months, and you just actually heard the AFA at the ARC promotion there during the break, and all of these registrations and dates and everything can be found over at afa.net/events, afa.net/events. Well, jumping to our next guest, we have on with us now Mississippi State Senator Jeremy England. Senator England's from, obviously, state senator in the state of Mississippi. Senator England, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you, Walker. Glad to be on today.
Well, Jeremy, tell us what part of the state you represent in the state Senate.
Yeah, absolutely. I represent Jackson County, which is down on the coast. I'm from St. Martin, which is a little community just north of Ocean Springs. And so I represent basically the middle portion of the county. So if you're familiar with the area, people familiar there know that is kind of the I-10 corridor area. That's where I represent.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Senator England, tell us, you've been working on election integrity and transparency issues for some time now, and you've got a couple different pieces of legislation you've worked on and introduced. But give us, before we jump into kind of the weeds of it and specific bills you've worked on, give us kind of a flyover as far as where Mississippi is when it comes to election integrity and transparency.
Absolutely. So, Walker, just last year, the lieutenant governor appointed me to be chairman of the elections committee in the Senate. And one of the most important things that we talked about was election integrity, campaign finance reform, things like that, that we could do better here in Mississippi. And as you know, last year when I visited with you, we were in the process of passing a ban on ranked choice voting. So we got that done last year. And this year we're looking more at what we can do for transparency, helping people understand who's donated to campaigns, how candidates are spending their money, and different things like that. And we're also looking at how we can help Mississippi voters ensure that their votes are counted and that they're timely counted, because that's another thing that always goes towards election integrity is on election night, you want to know who won and you want to be confident in who won as quickly as possible, as opposed to some of these other states where we see things drawn out, you know, over weeks before we really know who the winners are. So we've been really good at that here in Mississippi.
Yeah. On that note, what is, you know, when we have good leaders, and I'm talking about specifically at the statewide level, you know, a good governor, a good secretary of state, good attorney general, et cetera. You know, some of this stuff that, like you're seeing like Pennsylvania and other places, to your point, where it takes 3 weeks to count votes, that just doesn't happen right here because mostly we have competent leaders. But my concern is that what happens when you don't have competent leaders? And that's what these other states are dealing with. So, I mean, do we have good kind of barriers on the books that provide structure for these processes? Or is it something where if we, you know, turned around one day and we didn't have good statewide leaders, that this thing could really go off the rails?
Yeah, Walker, look, I think we're in a great position here in Mississippi. We have a great Secretary of State, as you mentioned. Our Lieutenant Governor was Secretary of State for 12 years. And for those who may not know, Secretary of State's office is who handles elections in most states, I imagine, but it's certainly here in Mississippi. And so we have good barriers. We have a good working relationship with our circuit clerks and with our elections commissioners, and they take these jobs very seriously. Now, one thing that I'm kind of concerned about, we're seeing some of our elections commissioners, their ages are getting up there. We've got to have people more my age and younger step into the election system, which is our greatest American tradition, is electing our leaders municipally and up through the state and even nationally. So it's very important that we have fair elections and that we're confident in our elections. And look, the one thing that we're dealing with a lot of times is even just perception. Because if you have that perception that something's not fair, which we look out from Mississippi and see these things going on in these other states, and the perception is obviously, well, what are they doing wrong? And we don't want that to happen here in Mississippi. We've been very good at that so far.
Yeah. Once again, we're talking to Mississippi State Senator Jeremy England, representing parts of the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Senator England, tell us some of the legislation you've worked on. You've presented a couple bills this year and previous cycles to address several areas when it comes to elections. So talk a little bit about that legislation.
Yeah, so specifically with regard to campaign finance reform, which is something that Lieutenant Governor campaigned on and something that we need to tighten up a little bit, just some gray areas. One being the fact that we limit corporations to $1,000 donation to candidates in Mississippi. But when we got to looking at that law, we got an opinion from the Attorney General that says, well, we're only limiting that to Mississippi corporations and to corporations doing business in Mississippi. So if they're a foreign corporation or a corporation, you know, set up in another state, they're not limited to that $1,000. So what we're looking at doing, we're either going to get rid of that $1,000 limit altogether, which is the only limit that we have, by the way, or we're going to make sure that applies across the board. We're also working with the Secretary of State's office to make sure that we have a good central online database that we want candidates all the way from, I think the Secretary of State says dog catcher up to governor, and I agree with him. Every office that you run for, we want you turning in your campaign finance reports. We want those to be online. We want them to be searchable. We want our voters to know who is giving to our campaigns and how we're spending that money as candidates. And we also came in, it's already illegal to donate as a foreign national to a candidate in Mississippi, but we did not have that same barrier with regard to ballot initiatives, which I understand is a tough issue here in Mississippi. We don't have a statewide ballot initiative right now, but local ballot initiatives even, we didn't want foreign nationals donating to those. So that has been my three bills that I've primarily focused on with regard to that this year.
Well, the foreign funding for ballot initiatives, you know, some people say, well, you know, where is that happening? It's actually happening. It's happened in a couple states, actually. And the vast majority of the time, the ballot initiatives are very much left-wing. They're left-leaning, Marxist type, you know, pro-abortion type ballot initiatives that are being funded by foreign sources. So this actually is a problem. It's not a hypothetical, Senator England.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. That's 100% a problem. And you hit it right on the head. We anytime we're dealing with ballot initiatives, which, as you know, we don't have one now, but we're, you know, we've got to be very careful with that because people are demanding it. But as you mentioned, ballot initiatives, it's my understanding we don't have a lot of conservative ballot initiative issues that are just in the pipeline ready to go. They're pretty much all liberal issues that are ready to go. And these are going to be sourced by other states and by other countries that want to come in and weaken conservative and family values here in Mississippi. So we've got to be very careful with that. And that's the aim of this legislation.
Yeah, that's for those who don't know, Mississippi's ballot initiative process basically got hung up at the state Supreme Court on a technicality, kind of. Really, there was a loophole basically where the process for going about a ballot initiative was very faulty legally. So it basically got hung up in court and hasn't been revitalized because it would take the state legislature bringing it back up and really resetting the barriers, the boundaries. But it's been a blessing in disguise because, as you mentioned, Senator England, this ballot initiative process probably for the last 5 to 10 years has been just a tool of the left. Everywhere you turn, the left is using it as a weapon against constitutional conservative values in our country. Not to mention, you know, it's really brought to light the fact that in many ways, the ballot initiative process, while I'm not 100% against it, I understand that it has its right place, especially with more of a 60, 66% threshold vote. But generally speaking, it's being used to subvert the will of the people. And I know that sounds kind of like contradictory, but when you pump in millions of dollars, like Florida happened with the abortion issue, when you pump in millions of dollars in out-of-state money, you can convince 51% of the people to believe in anything. And so that's where, to your point, states have to be very careful about breathing life into this ballot initiative process, because if you've got tens of millions of dollars to throw out there like the left does, you can convince 51% of the people to believe in anything.
That's right, Walker. And look, Mississippi probably has the biggest target on our back, being where the Dobbs case originated that overturned Roe v. Wade. So you can just imagine the amount of money that's sitting there and the process that these folks are coming up with from the left to try to word a ballot initiative in a way that it tugs at your heartstrings and it convinces people that, hey, we need to go put this these abortion rights back into the state of Mississippi. And we've got to fight that. And it's going to be a tough battle to win if you've got so much money being dumped into this state and so much power behind it, because they would love nothing more than to overturn our law here that originated the Dobbs case that overturned Roe v. Wade. And it's one of the most things that we're most proud of here is being kind of the tip of that spear.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, hey, a state senator, once again, we've been talking to Mississippi State Senator Jeremy England on all things election integrity and election process. Senator England, appreciate your work on this subject and many other. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Absolutely, Walker. Thank you for having me.
All right. Absolutely. That's Mississippi State Senator Jeremy England. And, you know, the ballot initiative process, look in Wisconsin, look in some of these other states. I mean, it has been just hijacked by the left. We've really got to rethink the whole process to begin with. And some states need to look at just rescinding it altogether. And if you want a law passed, well, you go through the state legislature. You do it the hard way, right? Instead of spending tens of millions of dollars to confuse people and muddy the waters on various policy issues. All right, one subject before we wrap up the program today. President Trump is just one thing after another as far as trying to improve the economy. And we're seeing prices come down across the board on various items such as eggs. They've dropped drastically in recent weeks. Gas prices are at a recent low over the last 5 years, at a 5-year low under President Trump, and they're continuing to drop. And I said, actually, 2 years ago, that I played a clip of an energy guy, kind of an energy talking head, saying, "Oh, oil will never go below $80 a barrel." Well, yeah, it is below $80 a barrel right now. So, and gas continues to, well, energy prices continue to drop. You know, fuel around here is down in the 240 range, $2.40 a gallon, which is pretty low. I'd like to see it go lower. I'd like to see 225, two and a quarter, $2, 190. I know that sounds crazy, but it could happen. But we've got to increase our refining capacity, okay, which is something President Trump is working on. But one more thing that President Trump has done over the weekend that is going to help relieve prices is he's going after the Houthis in Yemen. They've been clogging up the shipping lanes there. So let's listen to the State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce talking about targeting the Houthis.
The Houthis are pirates. They are not a recognized regime. They are not a recognized government. They are effectively holding Yemen hostage. And that's what they've been doing with the waterway there, is attacking shipping, attacking our ships over 100 times. It's been a kind of a constant death by a thousand cuts, if you will. And people are wondering, it's like, finally, we're striking back. This has been going on for a very long time. The previous administration has done pinprick responses when they've when the Houthis have attacked. But this is the first time that there is a real, genuine attack that is meant to have this stop. It affects the entire world, that shipping framework, where countries have had to go all the way around Africa in order to get into where it is they need to really be moving. And this is unacceptable in the civilized world. And that's what the goal is. It is not a tit for tat. This is a dynamic that is about making sure, like the rest of what the Trump agenda is, and certainly what Secretary Rubio is doing, which is to make the world safer and stronger and more prosperous, but also reasonable. These are pirates controlling a section of the world that affects all of us, and it's going to end, and we're going to help make it end.
All right, so President Trump and the Department of Defense over the weekend began targeting the Houthis in Yemen, the terrorist outfit that have been targeting not only container ships, but also U.S. military assets, U.S. Navy ships in the region. And they've actually sunk a couple of vessels in the region, in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, I believe it is. But this is, folks, this actually is going to directly, this is going to bring down prices, okay? I know this sounds crazy, how military action off the coast of Yemen could bring down prices. But folks, all these shipping vessels have been diverting their ships around the southern part of Africa, all right? And when you do the math on this, they're adding about 3,500 nautical miles to their ship, to their shipping time. Okay, these massive transport container vessels are adding 3,500 nautical miles in between 10 and 14 days to their travel time when they're having to avoid the Red Sea because the missiles are flying over their container ships. All right, and this has led to inflationary prices, rising prices. Because of the shipping cost. So we're going to see both energy and goods, other goods, come down, even retail goods come down pricing-wise by restoring free navigation through the Red Sea and through the Gulf of Aden. This is a big, big deal, not just on the military front, but on the economic front as well. We'll see you next time. Meet Kelsey. When she found out she was pregnant, she wasn't sure where to turn. But after meeting with the counselors at a preborn network clinic who loved and supported her, and after hearing her baby's heartbeat on a free ultrasound, she chose life.
When a mother looks at her child through a sonogram, it does something to you. You know, I ended up deciding to keep my son, who is now 5 years old today. He's amazing. He brings absolute joy to my heart. I could not imagine life without him. Not only did they help me save his life, they saved my life.
By introducing a woman to her baby on ultrasound, a baby's chance of life doubles. If you have the means, would you consider a leadership gift to save babies in a big way? Your tax-deductible donation of $5,000 will sponsor Preborn's entire network for 24 hours, helping to rescue 200 babies. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 on your phone and then say the keyword baby. Or you can donate securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.